Yeah.
There we go. Cool. So this is going to be kind of like, as I said, an interview format. I'm going to probably mix it in with several other people. I have some other people who were heavily involved in the X25 scene back in the mid 80s and whatnot. I actually grew up playing on GT Telenet and TimeNet as well. So that's one of the reasons like it's kind of fun to talk to you about this, because I know you used, Data XP. Is that primarily what you used?
Yeah, DotXP was the entry network that we used to go into the global X25 networks back then.
Okay.
But to us, I mean, we were living in a highly regulated environment, so there were no other offerings of X25. It was just a public phone public service, like the phone service, and so we didn't have a choice of using one or the other. There was .xp and that was it. So
in your area, you didn't have, for instance, like TimeNet available or any other X25 networks. That was one. Wasn't it sponsored by the postal system or something like that in Germany?
No, it was not even sponsored. It was owned by the postal system. So
got it.
Back in like the 80s, perceived idea of how networking would evolve was that it was kind of like an extension of the telephone system. And the telephone system back then, at least in most parts of the world, not so much in the US where it was already deregulated, but in the rest of the world, it was mostly regulated, and the carriers were all owned by the states. So there was one carrier in Germany, one carrier in Denmark, one in the Netherlands, and one in France. And all those carriers were not companies, really. They were just public entities. That was also reflected in the structure of the X25 standard itself, because it was a standard of the CCITT that was the global telecommunications union. And back then, the United States were kind of like an outlier in the sense that the rest of the world had these telecommunications systems owned by the states, and the United States had companies doing that. And that has totally reversed now. But back then, it was really the other way around.
Well, before we get too far into it, too, if you could just give a brief description of, you know, who you are, I know, for instance, in the mid 80s or so, you were known for basically using X25 networks to break into DOD and other or military, U.S. military type of things and stuff like that. But give, from your words, kind of a bio of yourself, what you did back then, what you're known for, and maybe like what you do today, if you want to.
Of course. So back then, what I was, basically, I was post high school student. So I was just finished with high school and going to be studying computer science at the university. So it was in between going to school and going to university. In school, I also already had some exposure to computer networking, because the schedule for the classes was run on a mainframe system. The mainframe obviously wasn't in our school. It was the local university's mainframe system. And one of the teachers, our physics teacher, used an acoustic coupler to connect to that mainframe to work on the class schedule. And that was really my first exposure to computer networks at all, because that acoustic coupler was in the same room where we had a bunch of Apple IIs that were used for the computer science classes. And one day or the other, we figured out how to dial out into that mainframe computer where our physics teacher would do the schedules and mess around with stuff and so on and so forth. So that was my first contact with computer networking, or From that, I got interested in first we dialed into that local system with our own acoustic couplers from home, and then later on we figured out that you couldn't only dial into your local mainframe, you could also use networks, because these mainframes would be networked. And then we figured out that there was this public switch network called DATXP, which allowed you to, if you had the suitable user ID, allowed you to connect to systems around the world. And I basically, because I was just finished with school and not yet started as a student, I had a lot of time at my disposal. So I spent a lot of time, just online, similar to what you would do online today, but only with very limited technical abilities. So the speeds were slow and we had no graphics and so on and so forth. But then on the other hand, we could go around the globe, connect to computers that were like in the United States or in all of Europe and so on and so forth. So, and as you mentioned, the military systems in the United States, it was not so much, I was not really into hacking specific stuff. It was more that it was interesting to just look what's there and use it. So most of the things that we could access, or where we could somehow find accounts that we could use, were in the global high energy physics community, because that community already had something like the internet today. They already had network connections between universities, between institutes. And those networks were really not very tightly secured, so you could easily figure out an account that would work like in Switzerland and then also somewhere else. And of course, we always imagined back then that networks would also be used by the military everywhere, and it was also knowledge in some sense that packet networks were created by the military in the first place, because they were so resilient against attacks, because packets could be rerouted everywhere. So of course we knew that there was some connection to the military, but quite frankly, I personally never saw anything that was really classified military systems. It was, we kind of thought sometime we might see those, but then on the other hand, we also had at least the idea that the military would be smarter about securing their systems than like the high energy physics community or anything else that we could access for that matter. So the story that kind of made me in a sense famous was that even though we didn't really have access to sensitive information, we had we always had the notion that we were kind of a very very small group of people that could what you would call surf the networks. Back in say 1987 or 1988, because we really were a very small group, and even though we didn't really know how many other people there were, it was quite clear that the general public didn't really know what we were doing. So there was this group of people who then got in touch with a representative of what was then called the KGB, that was interested in buying software from us, in particular software, because they couldn't access software, Western software, even though they needed it, because they cloned all the Vaxen and all the hardware that the West had. And that was kind of blown up into a story about military espionage and so on and so forth. It was really blown up more than it was in the first place. And what it served for, I mean, I'm not denying that I have been talking to Russian, to a Russian at one instance, but from the perspective of what we really did and how it was perceived in the public, there is quite some difference in what we really did and what the public was told that we could potentially do. So the whole story was also blown up to, well, raise awareness, if you will.
Yeah.
And that's quite understandable. So that's my backstory, if you will, or what happened out of that being an X25 hacker back in the day. I'm a programmer. I was a programmer and I'm still a programmer. So I made this into a living, and nowadays I'm still programming mostly boring commercial stuff. But I never really got into security much, because I kind of despise the most of the things that you need to sell or claim or do when you sell computer security. So I'm more of a systems hacker and also a non-systems hacker. I'm a programmer, if you will. So that's what I do now.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I'm kind of the similar way. So in an interview that I heard with you before, you described that you used to go after systems that you just found interesting. It didn't really matter if it was like a DoD system or a military system. You were interested in, for instance, this point in time, like Vaxxon and stuff like that, VMS, OpenVMS. And quite personally, that was like the same thing I was interested back at around the same time that you were doing this stuff. My preferred targets were VMS systems at the time. Mm-hmm. And we would use, and if I recall correctly, you use things like default accounts, field service accounts and whatnot to gain access to it. And we would do similar kind of techniques where we would look for demo accounts, guest accounts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, was that pretty much the case? Like, you didn't really care about, like, you were more interested in the computer system. You couldn't afford a VAX, so, but you still wanted to play with one. So, it was just a means to be able to play with one, really.
Well, you have heard that me claim that probably, and yes. it's true. So, of course, what I wanted to do is play around with computers. I don't know whether that would be, of course, but that was just my motivation. Just from the economic side, myself, I'm not from a wealthy family, so I wouldn't even have a home computer in the first place, and it took me quite a while to really own my own computer. Most of the computers that I used were just friends' computers, or in the school we had computers, or I could just go to X25 and access computers around the world. So that was really my key idea. I wanted to become a programmer, and I wanted to understand how these systems work. And of course, it would have been kind of my dream back then to own a VAX to really become a good hacker, because I realized that dabbling around at very slow speeds on machines that are like far away and that are used for a certain purpose, and that if I crashed them, they would just be unusable for the people who needed them, so they would throw me out. That all that kind of stuff that really put me off, and that was really my motivation. I wanted a big machine and use it for myself. So that was what I wanted back then.
Well, so now it's, you know, 30 years later. Do you own a VAX?
Well, certainly, of course. I had a lot of them. So of course, I never had really big ones, but I had a few micro VAX, and now I have a VAX station under my desk, and there's a VAX 4000 that I have in a basement somewhere. So I do own them, what I also realized is that, I mean, I was a fanboy, if you will. So I was really really of the opinion that OpenVMS, or well, VMS, not OpenVMS, because the open part of it really, that was shit. So, but VMS, that's like the real thing, and it is really great. And I would tell everybody. And there are emails in the network, well, in Usenet archives, where I claim ridiculous things, and it's really a bit embarrassing. So 30 years later, I would really say, well, I was a young person and I was a fan of something, but in retrospect, these things were not all that great in all respects. So I had this experience trying to write a web server on VMS with Lisp a few weeks ago, and that was really kind of, oh my God, how bad is this? And how awful did they implement the IP stack? And why were they so stupid to not think that this could be done right? And so on and so forth. So there is quite a lot of romanticism still, and I'm not totally detached from that. But I also know it's not factually, not a fact. It's more, well, this deck is dead, and I can be a fan of something that is dead. That's all right, but nowadays.
I'm in the same kind of situation. I have. I used to run a thing called a Death Row Cluster, where we had we would allow people around the world, whoever wanted to have access to our VMS boxes, to have an account on it. And we had an Alpha and a Itanium and a Vax, a 3100 Model 80 micro Vax. And so I kind of get that. And that actually kind of leads to one thing too, especially around the time. I mean. So you would run into things like Vax and stuff like that. Nowadays, everything seems very much like Linux, Windows. And that was one thing that I also thought was very interesting about X25 networks. You could find things that you wouldn't find. Do you have, like, I know that you primarily like Vaxin, but was there any other type of targets that you would run across that you found interesting at that point in time?
Well, of course. And the real reason why I got into Vaxin was that their help system was like the best. So back then there was this wide variety of systems that you could see, and so there was Prime, and we also had access to various TOPS 10 and TOPS 20 systems. And then, of course, there were some IBM mainframes, although using IBM mainframes from the terminals that we had was always kind of not the real thing, because you'd really want to have a asynchronous terminal for IBMs. But of course, PDPs and then Data General had a lot of nice machines with proprietary operating systems. But quite frankly, the Hangout, the chat system that we spent most of our time in 87 and 88, was a Unix box. It was an Altos Unix box. I think it was an 6820 running System 5. And a person at, well, Altos, nobody knows that now. So Altos was a computer manufacturer, and they had chosen Unix as their operating system, which was not the obvious choice back then, because most of the vendors of computers had their own proprietary operating system, but Altos was a Unix vendor, and they had this this Unix system that also could natively connect to X25, and they were running one of those systems in Munich. And there were two people on that worked for Altos in Munich, and those two people, well, one of them wrote a chat system in C, and the other one was the operator of the chat system, and that was the European. Well, I wouldn't claim that it was, well, it was our Hangout. So it was mostly Germans, but then some Australians, and then we always had some Italian folks in there. And sometimes some British folks would visit. So it was kind of an international community. But of course, like in an IRC channel, or what do people have today? I mean, nowadays it's more fragmented, but there were kind of these regulars that were there always, and I was one of those, and then there was a guy from Australia and as a regular, and some other people from Germany. So this was a very for a very long time, this was the place where we hung out. If we could, back then it meant that we could hang out there if we had access to X25, which required us to have a user identification, and that was really the thing to go for back then, because unlike today, where the internet basically is free, or is free if you are willing to donate some space on your screen to ads, back then you had to pay for each packet, at least in Germany. So right. the mode of operation was you had to, well, you wanted to talk about X25. So let me yeah. explain how that worked from our end. The way how we would start accessing that would be through acoustic couplers at 300 bits per second. So acoustic coupler is something, you have a phone, a regular phone with a line on the other end, a wired phone. Nobody knows that today. And it had that specific handset with a specific form. And there was a device called an acoustic coupler where you could put in the headset instead of holding it to your head. And this handset, in the acoustic coupler would then be used to transfer bits. And because that was done acoustically, hence acoustic coupler, there was a lot, well, shouting in the room where someone was using the network was really disturbing your connection, because it was actual tones that were sent through the phone line. And the speed was ridiculously low, so acoustic coupler either would be 300 bits per second, 30 characters per second, or there was also an asynchronous mode in Germany that was kind of popular, which was 1200 downstream and 75 bits upstream, under the assumption that you would type slow and want to get your data from your host fast. So with this acoustic coupler, you could, well, you put it into your phone, you put your handset into your acoustic coupler, and then you dial a number to connect to a host. And the first thing that we did was connect to hosts that were in our city, so like our university computers, or, well, yeah, mostly university computers. But then we found out that there was this public network, and this public network, this public X25 network called .xp, would also have a local dial-in number that you would call, you would get a simple command line interface, if you will. And before you could really make a connection into another system through the X25 network, it was basically a gateway, you had to identify yourselves using a network user identification, NUI. So having a NUI, that's what we call it, NUI. Do you have a NUI? Was like the common question among people in that era. With that NUI, you would indicate who would be paying for the connection, and the payment was based on packets. So every packet that you send, no matter how many bytes of the 64 maximum bytes of a packet that you would use, would cost you like 0.02 cents or whatever. So if you had a NUI, so you would connect to that DedXP gateway and then enter your NUI de blah blah, and you had to enter a password, and then with that you could enter a number, and that number could be either a German number starting with 445 or 44, depending on the type of host that you wanted to connect to, or it could be an international number starting with 0, like 03110, that would be Telenet in the United States, or 03106 would be Timenet, or 0228 would be Switzerland. So you could basically, like in the phone system, dial to systems that would be located around the world. With the bill being paid by the owner of the NUI that you had. And in particular, international connections were kind of expensive. So of course, our initial criminal motivation was to figure out NUIs that someone else would pay for so that we could surf the net for free. And that was mostly, well, either someone knew someone at a company and they were not very well, they didn't really know that this would costly and then give it away. And we even had a NUI that had that we later found out was paid for by DEC. And oftentimes you would go to a trade fair like CeBIT and look at booths to see whether someone was using .xp and spy their passwords. So that was a very, very early form of stealing passwords.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because I was just about to ask you how you guys end up getting NUIs and whatnot. See, a lot of in the United States, there were some X25 networks you could connect to. So, for instance, Telenet and whatnot. And it would allow you to connect to certain machines. When you connect up to the X28 pad, it would let you connect up to machines as long as they accepted the charges for it. So, for instance, like Citicorp used to accept the charges for it, so you could like scan that out. But you're saying, so from your standpoint, like could you not even use the pad until you had a NUI, or could you get on the pad and use it, but just to a lesser degree?
Yes, you could. You could either enter your NUI and then connect to any host. Or you could not enter an NUI and then connect to a host that would accept the charge. And that was called, of course, reverse charging.
Right.
And you would just prefix the number with an R. And that would indicate the desire to have the call be reverse charged to the host. And the host could then accept or reject the call. But there is this one story that I need to tell because it's very peculiar to Berlin. In Berlin, we had the situation that all local calls were free. And that's not something that is very strange to the United States. And it's basically not very strange to people around the world now anyway, because phone calls are basically free. But back then, it was normal in all of Germany that you had to pay by the minute for calls that you would make, except in Berlin. You remember, we had this wall around us, and one of the privileges that we had was that our phone system was never modernized, and as a result of that, local calls were free because they never bothered to install metering on local calls in the old phone system. So what this meant to us was that a pad connection, a phone connection to the pad, was 23 cents flat, no matter how long we stayed online. And being cheapskates all the way, of course, our optimization goal was to stay online as long as we could. So we happened to be, well, we, and I really don't know how many, but maybe have been 10, 15 people. So at least I did that. So when our NUI somehow didn't work anymore, and of course, when the bill came in, oftentimes the password was changed because it tended to be expensive if 20, 30 hackers from all of Germany used your NUI. So once that happened and we did not have a NUI, what I then did was use a park NUA. So we had some, we knew some systems that would allow reverse charging, and that didn't have a timeout on their login prompt. So you could reverse charge, connect to that machine. What I used most of us used a machine in Düsseldorf called, it was a Prime system. There were always, when the NUI didn't stop to work, there was like 15, 20 connections to that Prime system, which accepted reverse charging, and nobody ever tried to log in because we knew we didn't have any logins to that machine. It was I think it was of the council of the city or something. But they accepted the reverse charge, and we could park there until the next NUI came, and we still use that 23-cent connection to then go online and have fun again. So that was a very particular situation in Berlin, and of course. I don't know how familiar you are with the situation, but we had the wall around us. We were in West Berlin and they had the wall around us, but we belonged to West Germany, which was like 150 miles to the west. And between West Berlin and West Germany, there was the east, and we wouldn't really be there. So, but our friends or the other people that we knew from Germany that were also in X25 and were also hackers, all were from West Germany, and they always envied us that we could stay online in DATEXP for days and days and days for 23 cents, and they couldn't because they had to pay, I think, 23 cents per 8 minutes or something like that. So
just understand, like, so you would connect up and then you would use the NUI till it basically died, because either the person paying the charges or whatnot, they'd realize this. And then you would just park your connection on a prime system, it sounds like.
Yeah.
That would basically just say, I want you to log in, but you knew it wouldn't time out, so that your pad connection would, your X28 pad connection would just stay alive.
Correct.
And then you would just... Okay, that's kind of funny.
I looked up in some old Frag magazine, they have a nice newer list, an international newer list of X25 systems, and the system that I'm talking about is still of course in there. It's Stadt PrimeNet Stadt Düsseldorf. It was a city council system, whatever. And it's in there, so I haven't dreamt this. That's what happened.
That's hilarious. From the standpoint, so I mean, you're obviously reaching out to different DNICs, like trying to find different targets and whatnot. Were you guys mostly writing your own software to do things like scanning? So if you're sitting on your network, and then you're reaching across through like what 3110 DNIC, like the telenet, right? Mm-hmm. Were you just writing your own software, or were you using stuff like that you found on bulletin boards, or how did you guys like find the systems you were targeting?
Well, I wrote one or two scanners, but the annoying thing about writing scanners that worked through the pad was that it was really, really slow. So one of the big dreams always was to have the documentation to VMS, what was it called, the VMS X25 system, I forget. So there was this network package on VMS that allowed you to connect a fast serial line to a VAX and then talk X25 natively rather than through a pad, and writing a scanner for that was like the holy grail, the dream, to write a scanner that could scan at 9,600 bauds and get clear rejection messages and all that, because it was, of course, it was painful to write a scanner that would use an acoustic coupler, which is notoriously unreliable, and oftentimes you just get junk characters, and then your error message could not really be parsed, and all that kind of crap. So that was the holy grail. But I myself, as a programmer, of course, wanted to do that, but I never really had the documentation back then to do it on the VAX.
So it sounds like to me the real thing that was holding you back was having an auto dial modem. At that same point, I mean, because if you'd had that, then you could have dialed into the pad. And granted, it would have been slow. It wouldn't have been as cool or as fast as using the VAX. But was that kind of like the holdback? Like you didn't have. So I used to write those, and for Telenet, what it would basically do is dial into the pad, and then you would scan a whole bunch, and at some point the pad would just kick you off, and then it would just, okay, I just drop carrier, then it just pick back up and pick a number out of the pool that Telenet would have for my city, and just dial, pick one at random and dial back in and start rescanning again, and then drop off. So, I mean, was this a time like you didn't have, if you'd had the auto dial function, that probably would have, you know, you could have done scanning directly from there.
That was really a bit later because we did not have modems. We really had acoustic couplers back then. So, and that means no dialing. We had to dial ourselves, and if the pad disconnected us, it disconnected us. Right. So and I mean, you, of course, in the United States, you would have free local calls. So you call your...
Right. True. Pad. Good point.
Yeah, and you would just redial and that's it. But to us, it was expensive. So our optimization target was to either use the pad connection as long as we could, or better yet, use a host in the network to scan, because that would be faster and more reliable anyway. So that was kind of the idea.
So what kind of hardware were you using at the time? Like, what was your personal machine? It's 1987. You're at home or wherever you are. What was your workstation like at that point for this type of hacking?
So I had an Altos terminal. It was just a serial terminal, and I was a little paranoid. So that was what I had, and I for one, I was not very rich, so I couldn't really afford an IBM PC. But then on the other hand, I also was kind of prouding myself. Proud that I didn't have a printer and I didn't have any way to store stuff on my machine. So, and I got busted a few times. And all I had was like this terminal that couldn't save anything. You switch it on and then you go online, and the written notes that I used. So I only had written notes. So that was what I was using. I had an acoustic. Well, I think I had a modem. Then I had the terminal. I had a modem. But when I was really into hacking systems and into trying stuff, I just had a terminal.
There's one point in, so I watched 23 just recently. Actually, I didn't even know that movie existed until just a few days ago. Watched it, and it was a pretty fun watch. But there was like a scene where there's a PDP 11 that's bought, and you're going to use it for password cracking. It almost sounds like, and I kept thinking, that doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. Did that actually happen?
Well, this movie is a movie about Carl, and everything in that movie is all the reality is bent to support the story around Carl. So it is more a story about a fallen youth than a hacker's movie, in the sense that it's trying to be true to this hacker story. But I can tell you that this PDP 11 was actually bought. So they actually bought a broken PDP 11 from some vendor that, well, from a scrapyard, and it didn't work, and it was a total mess and a disaster. But it was more in the sense of, oh wow, now we have money, let's get a real machine. And then they couldn't get a Vax because it was too expensive, and they bought a PDP just because they could.
Oh, so it really had nothing to do with, like, for instance, in the movie, they try to portray it as like, we can crack passwords faster. Again, it didn't make it very much sense to me. But at the time I was watching, I was wondering if that was true. That was just kind of like a side thing after watching the movie. I thought there's a scene where his Atari, I don't remember what type of a, was it Atari 800 or something like that?
Oh, he had a 520. So Carl had a 520. And he had a 520, and some things are really accurate. So he had a 520, and that was a decent hacking machine, because it had a decent VT100 emulation. Well, in the beginning, it had a decent VT52 emulation, which was not all that bad, because a lot of a lot of the terminal programs back in the day didn't really do anything useful on a VEX. So on an Atari, you at least had 80x24, and you had a VT52 that worked, and you had a keyboard that you could even use the gold key if you wanted to. So it was already kind of going there. But this PDP story is, I mean, it is more one of the things. Well, we smoked weed all the time, and it was, well, we need a machine ourselves just to have it, because we deserve it, and let's, well, anything that is big and makes noise, and well, let's get it. But I wasn't personally involved.
Okay. Yeah, well, I mean, and I can't blame him. I've owned a PDP 1123, and we largely got it because it was big and it looked cool. It had little to do with what we were doing at the time. It was also kind of like rescuing a machine as well. But so you weren't, it sounds like it was really difficult to scan X25 networks because you're on a acoustic couplers. You're kind of, you know, to write software, you didn't have auto dialing functionality. How did you find the any ways that you wanted to target then?
I did most of my own discovery. Well, I scanned a bit, and the even though it wasn't really that easy to scan using 300 baud acoustic couplers, it still worked, and we did it. And it was easier because the numbers were very structured. So. Part of the addresses were the area code that you wanted to connect to, and then they were just increasing numbers starting from, well, you know what type of interface you were, or type of network interface you were searching, so you knew that you would start with 40 and then three zeros, and then scanning like a range of 100 or 200 numbers would already give you a good certainty that you had seen everything that is in that city or in that area code. But apart from that, most of the discoveries that I made myself were in the HapNet, because that network was really unsecure and had discovery mechanisms. So HapNet is the decknet that was used between universities and other physics institutions in high energy physics research. And that was a global network, not based on X25, but on the proprietary DEC protocol, where scientists were using it, and they were using email, and it was easy to find passwords and emails, and a lot of the systems were not secured very much. So this was really the network that was most hacker friendly, because machines were at it all the time, and it was a friendly environment. It was friendly for the scientists and also for the hackers. So that was more the research network, if you will, where we researched and found new things.
So would you get on like, for instance, like a VAX, a VMS system, and run NCP and like look at show null nodes and like go through a node list and figure out like how to move? How did that work?
Yeah, exactly that. So that would just be show null nodes and show null areas, and then okay, we have something, and then write a little DCL script to see whether whether you could just execute commands on the remote machine, and then try phone and see what users are logged into that VAX. Oh, there is someone logged in. Let me phone them. So I had interesting conversations just phoning people from like CERN was the biggest kind of hub for high energy physics in Europe, and from CERN you could get to like everywhere, and a lot of machines were listed in DCL scripts that you would find, and you would well, of course you would look at emails to see scientist A would write to scientist B, well, we are doing this experiment on this machine, and you can connect with this user and do that. So
right.
There you go. So that was how we explored most of the networks. But there were also, back then it was, I as a Vex hacker really found that to be, well, that was my, what I really did a lot. And I, what I often did is install my own chat system on these machines, or write a little mailbox that you could leave stuff behind and stuff like that. But of course there were a lot of other interesting system switches. So for example, TimNet to us was more was not really the one of the big networks. It was a number that you could call, and then that was 03106, and then it would present you with a prompt, and you could enter a system name. And one of the systems there was a system that was called was it called NSA or something. It had something to do with secret services in the United States. So you could connect there, and it would give you general information on how to become a spy and how to apply as a hacker. But of course, U.S. citizenship required. So there were a lot of these kinds of systems where you had a prompt, and then you could fool around and discover other systems like this. This NSA system, or there was a very relatively popular system in ETH Zurich, which had a TOPS 20 box and a few modems that you could dial out into Switzerland and so on and so forth. So sometimes we just say, oh yeah, there's this new switch, and do you know what it is? And we tried it out and found maybe a modem. So dial outs were really a big thing, and that was also very very popular for some time. So at some point we found a lot of modems that had auto dial capability in the United States that would allow us to call into bulletin board systems in the United States. And of course that would be too expensive to do from Germany directly, but then suddenly we could call bulletin board systems in Seattle and download Amiga wares or stuff like that. So that was really, really, really nice. And that was to the system operators, or to the owners of these BBS systems, it was always really kind of, when they had their first visitor coming through a dial-out modem from Europe, that was always kind of a fun encounter, if you will. If you run your Amiga-based bulletin board system, and someone calls the operator and tells, "Well, I'm sitting in Berlin," and first thing is, "Well, yeah, right."
No, really, I am. No, actually, that was one of the major modifications for whenever there used to be a service in America called PC Pursuit, which used Telenet, and that was a out dial system. Basically, and that's some friends of mine noticed that it kept calling this local number, but then would somehow transfer you across the country to LA, to wherever you're trying to. Then you pay PC Pursuit for access to their network, but then it was looking at the underlying network. Then we actually started looking for out dials that were not necessarily PC Pursuits. So, and then using those to dial bulletin boards, kind of like circumventing the system. That was always like a big target of ours with X25, because, nowadays, as you kind of pointed out, the phone calls are basically free. And even network traffic is basically free. But at that point in time, somebody had to pay for it. So if you could find a way to make an out dial phone call in Boston to call some BBS, that was a major win for us.
Yeah, of course, that was same with us. So of course that was a big motivation, and then being, well, wares, of course we're big, so getting US wares to Germany, that was a big motivator for some people that had home computers. I didn't have one, so I didn't really do that, but we, there was kind of an overlap between people that were mostly interested in the wares scene and getting access to out dials, and the hacker scene that was mostly surfing and dialing around.
So what was the hacker scene like in so you're in Berlin at the time when this was going on, correct? What was the hacker scene like there? I mean, was it mostly people doing X25 stuff, or again, I mean, so you had to pay for the phone call, so war dialing was kind of already out. That would be very expensive to do. And you would have to have like my thing, I had a Commodore 64 and I had a 1660 and 1670 modem, you know, it was auto dial, so I could do all that kind of stuff. So I mean, what was it like, the scene like there then?
Well, it I mean,
was there a scene?
Of course, there was a scene, but there have probably been a lot of different scenes. So where I was participating first, I was coming out of this chatting system in Bitnet. So this was, Bitnet was really my gateway chat network that also provided me with the information how to use X25 in the first place, because this university host that my physics teacher used was also connected to Bitnet. And Bitnet, nobody knows it nowadays. It was a mainframe network between mostly universities around the globe. It was called EARN, E-A-R-N in Europe, but in the United States it was called Bitnet, and it had this relay chat facility, and that's why what IRC is coming from, the name IRC, Internet Relay Chat, is really the Bitnet relay chat in the internet. So back then that was like revolutionary in the sense that you had this global scope of chatting where you could talk about things and we're not restricted to your town or your country. You could chat with anyone. So that was kind of the gateway. What was I talking about? Sorry.
I think it was about, well, actually, to be quite honest, I trailed off there.
Yeah, well, talk to old people about the old times, and it's always ending up in, oh, it was so good.
You know, it's funny, you mentioned that with a buddy of mine, and about how as the years goes on, it gets more and more kind of fun to talk about, because it's such a foreign subject to a lot of younger people. So when you say, no, you had to pay for the phone call, you know, did people look at you like, what? I mean, that seems strange. It wasn't just free. Like, you know, the idea of like collect calls and whatnot are a foreign thing to them.
Yeah, you were asking about the hacker scene. So, of course, it came out of the BBS scene. So the first, I mean, how I got first exposed to people that were like me was through calling BBSs in Berlin, and then through Bitnet it became more global, if you will. So in the first place, of course, it was more across Germany, and I met with other people that were in Germany, and then the first people I really met that were doing the same thing, except for my co-students. There was like three, four, five people that I studied together with that did the similar things. Was through the CCC. So I went to this CCC Congress in Hamburg, and then there I met people that I had met online before, and this became kind of the group of people that I interacted with. So there was a group of Vax hackers, which I was part of, and then there was this group of what later became this KGB's story. There was an overlap between the two groups, but it was really different. And then the Vax hackers kind of said I had been trading the Vax hacker knowledge to the Russians and blah blah blah, but it was, I mean, that was what it was. And most of the people in that scene were organized through either the CCC, or it was also a group in Munich called the Bayerische Hackerpost. That also had meetings, and where there was a core group of 10 people or so that also were in the network, were kind of using X25 or were trading wares or doing tests or so. So that was the scene that I was in.
It sounds like to me, I mean, if you wanted to, especially back then, like as you said, in the United States, we had opportunities through different X25 networks. So, and because of the way of our system is, so, you know, Telenet, TimeNet, you know, and whatnot. But it sounds like to me, I mean, if you're going to be a hacker and it's 1987 and you want to access machines outside of your country at that point in time, that was the way to do it, really.
Right. And as you asked earlier, what other networks we access, we didn't really know because to us, it were just numbers and prefixes. So we just dialed 0228 blah, 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 blah to access the system in Switzerland. And of course, we were using SwissPAC at that time, but we didn't really know because we really just saw the numbers.
Right. And you didn't have like necessarily a list of all the DNECs associated with, I'm assuming, like it, where you could say like this number is associated with this country or whatnot.
We knew that this was a country, but to us it was more countries and not networks, if you will. So as I said earlier, because every country had only one network, at least from our perspective, you had a prefix and it was associated with the country. And of course, that country had an X25 network, but it was like the phone network. It was the Danish or the Swedish or the French phone network and not a particular brand or whatever.
Oh, I gotcha. Do you remember, like, what, I mean, obviously, Telenet and stuff like that. Do you remember what other DNICs that you guys went through? I mean,
in the United States?
Well, no, anywhere, not just the United States, just like any, like, were you hitting TransPAC? Were you hitting, you know, DataPAC? Anything that will give you a connection, I'm assuming, yeah, so you can play with something.
I cannot really tell you the names of the networks. We used machines in Sweden, in Denmark, in the Netherlands, in France, in Italy a lot, in Germany, of course, in Spain sometimes, but it was kind of rare. And then sometimes we even had systems in Australia or in like Africa, those were really like the outliers. And if you look at the Frag Nur list, that was basically our phone book. That was like how we went about, and none of these numbers really have DNICs associated with them. It's just countries. That's how we looked at them.
Okay. No, right on. And there was something also really kind of cool, especially at that point in time, to be sitting at your Commodore 64 or whatever it was at the time and realizing that I'm connected to a VAX in, you know, 4,000 miles away or whatnot. There was something really about that.
Yeah, that was really, really, really cool. And the best phone conversation I'm getting at that was with Carl Ludig at Caltech. Phone was the chat system on Vaxen, which came with the system, and the distinguishing feature of phone compared to most chat systems even nowadays was that you could see the characters as they were typed by the partner that you were talking to. So you had shared screens. One area of the screen was your part of the screen. The other area was your partner's area of the screen.
Right, and it was a split screen kind of setup.
Yeah, and when they typed a key, then that key would immediately be shown. So that was a very kind of intimate form of online communications, because you could see when they corrected something and how fast they typed and whatever it was. And I had this conversation with Carl Ludig at Caltech when I was logged into his machine, and he was the system manager, and I told him, well, hey Carl, I had an account. I created my own account on his machine, and he didn't know that. So but he was curious enough to talk to me. So of course, a part of the conversation went on about why do you have an account on my machine? But the other part of the conversation was, I'm looking at the Bay Area and the sun is rising now. So that was kind of a fun thing to do, you know. I mean, because it was at night on my side, of course, and we talked on a human fashion, but also on a, we also were kind of like enemies, if you will. So it was intense, and it was fun.
Yeah, no, actually, that sounds really cool. Yeah, I guess it was just kind of a different time too. Just like he probably looked at it as like, this guy's kind of annoying, but you know, whatever.
Whatever. I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, there's this story of Clifford Stoll, of course, that of course you know that yes. The cuckoo's egg, which is also kind of in the same sense. There were these moments of, well, I need to figure out what this technical problem is, and then there, on the other hand, there is this perspective on there is a person that I'm interacting with or that I need to track down, and Clifford Stoll really describes this in a very good way, I would say.
Looking back on it, I mean, do you find that book like represented what was going on fairly well, or?
Well, I think it is honest to what he
was seeing.
Yeah, right. What he was seeing and what he experienced, but I still don't think that that it is representative of the whole story that was going on, because it went on for so long. He describes how he got into touch with like the authorities and the FBI and the German Bundespost and so on and so forth. And there have been all these conversations between all the other people that have not been talking to Cliff when he wrote the book. And we don't know anything about that. So what was their motivation to let it continue? How did they feed him information? We don't know all that. That story will never be told. But I think from the perspective of how he perceived it and how he then let himself become part of that thing or be driving that story, and how he describes it, I think that's pretty nice and pretty to some degree also pretty honest. Mm-hmm. Although he doesn't really reflect on how he might have been used as a tool as well, but who knows, right? I mean,
right.
And that's just speculation. So I think it was a nice read. I read it and I liked it.
When was the last time you read it?
Sorry?
Last time you read it?
Once, like 30 years ago.
yeah, that's what I figured.
I remember that I wasn't. I mean, there are these stories that make up things and that somehow speculate about what else, but he didn't do that. So he just did. He just describes what his story with this is and what he thought would be going on, but he never came up with all these speculations on everything else. And that's kind of nice, I think. I mean, that's really.
It really was. But actually, I have to say, when I had no idea, 23. The German movie had come out. So that was actually very interesting to watch. Cause I thought it was an interesting perspective from, because you're kind of like a composite character in that movie. Was it David or something like that?
Right. And David is myself and someone else, another friend of Carl.
Okay, good. I thought that was the case. I was pretty sure. But it was interesting to seeing from that side of things. Do you feel the same thing about 23?
No. 23 is not at all a documentary.
Sure.
And what it really tries to depict is Carl's state of mind and Carl's struggle with his illness, if you will. So everything else in the movie is just taken from the reality and bent to shape to help the story, if you will. So it's not an honest account of what had happened, and it doesn't do anyone but Carl any justice. Well, I am not even in there, but I'm not talking. I'm just saying I don't exist as a person in that film. But also the way how Pedro and Dob are shown, that's not what they were. I mean,
right.
These people that are playing, these actors that are playing these characters are not playing the people that have been involved, that were really different people. And I mean, I know many of them, so I can say that everyone but Carl is really not shown well. But okay. Carl performed well, and that's what I like about that movie, because he really failed, and that's what the movie really shows, that this person has somehow really messed up.
Gotcha. Well, hey man, it's been really, really cool talking with you about X-25 stuff, and I know we kind of veer off a little bit there, but it's kind of hard not to do when talking to you.
Of course, no problem.
As you pointed out with my buddy, it's like it's still kind of fun stuff to talk about, and actually that's the reason, you know, I want to do things like this particular podcast, so we can talk about things like I don't want it to kind of like be, you know, washed away, kind of, so to speak, about like how these techniques used to be used. And for instance, you know, using, oh, well, actually I have one other question for you. So I know you used default accounts, field service and whatnot. What other accounts did you go after? Did it, like guest and demo? Did you have any, I'd always go after like node names.
Yeah.
So I went to the system and the system was called like, Electric Boogaloo or whatever it might be called, I would use that as a username and password. I would try to do different things.
I was never very great at that, I must say. I had my list of things that I was trying. In the very first days when VMS 2 was still out there, or 3, I think 3 was the one that also had sys-test and sys-test UETP.
Yes.
Foolproof accounts. But then what was very popular was also having a visitor account. So, and visitor as username, I think it's pretty much a British word. Mm-hmm. Or at least I have seen that a lot in Europe and not so much in the United States. So visitor always also often worked. Getting access through either proxy access from in the HapNet environment, or stealing passwords from emails, that was really then the most fruitful way of doing stuff.
Did you guys ever set up any kind of there's in 23, there's a point where you guys set up like a Trojan so that people will think they're logging in, then it tells them that they're, you know, password incorrect and ships them, I would assume, over to a real login prompt. Did you guys do anything like that?
Yeah, well, that thing, there was a patch to login out that was done by someone in Karlsruhe, I think. And that was very, very popular, because basically what it did was it wrote down the password when you logged in. When someone logged in, it wrote down the password in clear text so that we could then grab that from a file. So that was happening, sure.
So were you involved in that, like where, say, you would compromise the system? And you'd have to have like system administrator, like you'd have to be system, wouldn't you, to patch the login?
Yeah, of course, but it would still be interesting to have the password, because then
the other
systems. So that's what we did, and event or one evening I was hacking about in a system in I think it was in England. And someone phoned me that I didn't know, and identified themselves as another hacker, a British hacker. He said, "Well, he said he was from Great Britain and blah blah blah." And we talked a bit, and then he gave me a little hint, saying that there was this bit in the process header called Delpen, and I should have a look at that. So I that was really fun, because I mean it was a very, very specific bit of information that this stranger gave me, knowing that I was another hacker, and I had the impression that this guy really knew a lot and wanted to just, well, here, little guy, I have something for you. But it was really an interesting information, because I then figured out what this bit is. It is a bit in the process header that tells the system that your process is being deleted, or that this process is being deleted. So if you set this, well, usually to delete a process, the system would set the bit and then initiate the deletion by setting ASTs or arranging that the process would die eventually. But if you set the bit and don't do that, then your process would become invisible and also unkillable. And that was really a nice tool, because I figured out how to set that bit in using a change multi-kernel, blah, blah, macro 32 program. And I had a tool that basically made me invisible on machines where I had all privileges. And that was fun.
So to a system administrator who's on, he does a show process is full. You're not in there?
I'm gone.
Yeah, you were doing much cooler stuff than I was.
I mean, of course, there was.
But you needed that permission first, so you already had to have
privileges, of course. So most of the fun stuff, of course, was starting with having all privileges. But then there was where these bugs, and then there was a I don't remember the details, and we are now digressing into VNS, but
that's
was
fine. This is more for me at this point.
Yeah. So wasn't there a bug in login out that allowed you to log in with full privileges without having an account in the first place? So something like that. And it was in 4.1 or whatever.
I was gonna say, it would have been an early version.
Yeah. So it was in 4 whatever, or even in 3. So it was very early, but it was so devastating and so embarrassing that they really had to patch their way quickly. And everybody, well, all the hackers thought, well, this must have been the NSA to implant a defector in all the machines that they export and blah, 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 blah. Because it's so obvious. So that was the kind of stuff that we really were after, of course.
No, of course. So you guys did create the like kind of false login page kind of thing, and the Trojan kind of give me your username, give me your password. No, sorry, incorrect. Now here's the.
No, I did not do. I didn't personally do that. But what I was involved in was this patch to login out, which was even better because. We had this write down password function, and we also had like a master password, so you could use any username and a certain password and be logged in if you had patch login out. So and that really was before these systems had any form of hardening and checksums. Right. Across or anything, so you would just patch login out and then reset the date, and nobody would really be able to.
No.
I mean, if you had full privileges on a machine, then it was usually because it was maintained poorly, and then if it was maintained poorly, then they were screwed when we hit them. So
yeah, it was kind of to keep a foothold into the machine. Really, right. At that point, I mean, you already had system privileges, so you're kind of like backdooring it. I mean, I remember doing things like, so for instance, do you know, I'm sure you're familiar with like Multinet, TCP stack for VMS.
Yeah.
And I remember like noticing FTP wouldn't report login failures to Opcom, which remember used to be like kind of a thing.
So
I remember like, and saying, well, I'll just brute force everything through FTP. On multinet systems, because it will never ever. So I can do this thousands of times, and it will never report through Opcom.
Very useful knowledge. When you would try scanning accounts through login out, you would get logged out after a while. So if you had a way to probe passwords without doing that, that would be very nice, right? I
mean, right.
VMS is still a fun thing, and I recently discovered I had this journey figuring out Vex List, because I am a Vex list hacker as well now, so I did it for a decade and really got fond of it, and well nowadays I'm not doing it a lot anymore, but I found Vex List binary 2 years ago, and then I found the I figured out who was the engineering manager and talked to him into giving me a manual so that I have a real manual and so on and so forth. And that now I'm whenever I'm traveling and I'm traveling to the US a lot, I always have Vax List with me, and if I see a Vax that runs in a museum, I try to run it there, and it's always fun to have something that people haven't seen. So yeah.
Well, you know, it's been, so I'd said I used to run a project called the Death Row Open BMS Cluster. Mm-hmm. And I used to run it with a lot of guys, and some of them were old BMS engineers, like Dave Cutler. I get to be a friend of his, and Hoffman, Stephen Hoffman, stuff like that. And that was always like really cool to like, do you know Hoffman?
Well, no is the wrong word, but he is still on CompOS BMS.
No, he is. He's a really cool guy, by the way.
I know, but on CompOS BMS, he is really difficult. So just recently, when I had this Vax List exploration, and when I explored it, one of the things that really annoyed the hell out of me was that it has an Emacs editor. You probably know Emacs. And Emacs. And Emacs uses Control S for search. So Control S, you know it. It's
for X on, X off. Yeah.
It's X off. So it really annoyed the hell out of me because my editor needs to work like I know it works, and it needs to have Control S to search. So and nowadays I don't need no X on X off.
Right.
I don't need that. So I tried to, and you can reconfigure your Vax List editor to use Emacs compatible key bindings, but you cannot bind Control S and Control Q. It tells you cannot do
that. It is for flow control. So
right. What? Okay, I get that. Back then, you had to use it for flow control. Right. But in the did you read that exploration of mine?
No, otherwise, no, I
have not. No. It will only take 5 minutes. So I went into the disassembler to see why it wouldn't allow me to bind Control S and Control Q, and I found that there is code in Vax List that explicitly checks for those characters and tells you cannot do that. So I thought, well, okay. I can change that and patched it using a patch. Because then it works, and then you set host sync off and TTY sync off, and you are fine and dandy because your terminal is fast and you don't need that crap. And then I asked on CompOS VMS, well, I want to do this. Is there any other reason why I would not be wanting to do that? Why would I not be able to use Control S and Control Q for searching? And Stephen Hoffman really got agitated about that. And he said, well, if you do that, then, well, everything will break and the world will...
Everything will break.
Yes, I get it back then, but now... And he was totally not in this century. He really was, and then I said, and after a few emails, a few postings where he was insisting that it's like that, and I said, well, okay, I get it back then, but can I do it? And then I summarized it, saying, well, okay, I get it back then, you had to do it, but now it is not a problem.
He 2019, right?
He couldn't just not post. He posted. Saying, no, you cannot. It is supposed to be. Okay, I get it.
I mean, he's an old school deck kind of guy. And and by the way, if you actually want to talk to him in real time, go to irc2600.net/VMS. He hangs out there all the time. And and think about it from my point of view. This is the way that I met him. I was putting out many years ago, this thing called the Open BMS HackFac, mm-hmm. right? And then I set up the Death Row cluster, which allowed people on like to, you know, have free accounts to try out BMS and have a good time with it and just play with it and, you know, something other than Linux for a change or Windows. And I will say he was really cool about, you know, he was kind of, you know, you know, this is kind of like a weird project. All your servers are named after serial killers. I'm not sure if I can get behind this, but in the end, and it kind of did that as kind of a joke, the serial killer thing. But because nobody forgets if they tell it to a vax named Manson. That was the kind of the idea. But actually, over time, I got to know him, and he's a really nice guy. But he has some very strong opinions, and I've talked to him many times, and he's a very knowledgeable guy. I'll bet you if you got on IRC and just talk with him, he'd probably, you know.
I'm not saying, well, he's just an old guy, and I'm just a random guy from the internet that is actively fighting his belief. That's normal that you cannot just give in.
That X-on, X-off needs to still be a thing.
Yeah. that's how it is.
He's actually a nice guy. If you ever want to and want to chat with him, he's over there a lot. So
I do believe you. Thank you.
But hey, man, it's been awesome talking with you, man.
Okay, let me know when you are finished with cutting this together, and I want to hear the other voices.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I have a guy who did one of the last scans of DataPack in Canada. I want to talk to him. I have a friend of mine, Jay Falcon, that I've done. So in about, I don't know, it was around 2007 or so, we started scanning X25 networks because we knew they were going to be dying out. Mm-hmm. So we're connecting up to Transpac, and India has a thing called iNet, so we're connecting up to that. And it's trying to experience as many of them as we possibly could. And we put on a talk at Hackers on Planet Earth in New York and whatnot. So I want to get him on. I want to talk to him because his, kind of like me and you, a lot of our upbringing or whatnot was around X25. And that being kind of a gateway outside of your local city, you know. Mm-hmm. Dial BBS. X25 was the first network that, you know, we kind of experienced where you go, wow, I can connect to this machine in Los Angeles or, you know, around the world or whatnot. So I'm going to do an interview with him and the DataPack guy, and then try to put it together. It's probably going to be about a month or so. So okay. It's immediate. But I really, really appreciate it, man. It's been really awesome talking.
Yeah, just let me know. I'm interested. I mean, did you read the Friendly Orange Glow? This book about the Friendly Orange Glow. Did you hear about that?
No, I did not.
Oh, that's some. That's an interesting book that describes a system written in the university. In the 60s and 70s at the University of Illinois. Well, it's a mainframe-based multi-user system that was used for, well, that was intended for educational purposes and then became a huge communication system with games and chat and blah, 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 blah. And it was really, really big in the northeast, basically. And it's interesting because the thing is they had they didn't even have a terminal technology back then that they could use, and as you know, in the 60s the having memory for storing the characters to display on the screen was one of the issues that you had to solve. So they came up with their own plasma display technology so that they could connect like 100 users to a machine without really getting very, very expensive. And it's all faded back. But the Friendly Orange Glow is something that I can really recommend.
The Friendly Orange Glow.
The Friendly Orange Glow. Yeah. It's, just Google that.
I'll look it up tonight.
Yeah. But why I mentioned that is that one thing that is not in existence is live version of that system. So there is no way how you could see these application, how someone would use them. And I always find that very sad. It is really interesting to see these systems, how fast or slow they are and what you would type. And it would be interesting to have something like that for X25, I think. So
That's actually a really good point. I mean, because if you look, so for instance, in the freaking community and whatnot, you have voice over IP, which I'm sure you know about, but I mean, voice over IP became kind of a big thing. So you have things like Asterisk and stuff like that, that kind of got very evolved and whatnot, but they built systems that would kind of mimic. So for instance, if you wanted to mimic blue boxing, you know, or red boxing or whatnot, that you can call into these systems and they'll mimic. They'll act like it used to act, you know, whatnot. So I kind of see what you're saying. So you're thinking like kind of like a system that would bring you back to that day. This is what, you know, 30 characters per second kind of thing looks like. This is what it feels like kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm just dabbling, but I think to get a feel what this was like, talking and hearing stories of the time is interesting, but seeing what this really meant is something that we might be able to recreate or know how it really looked like, but in 10, 15 years, it's really lost. So if you are trying to keep the X25 memories alive, that would be maybe something where I would also be interested in contributing.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up. I was looking up the other night, in Linux and whatnot, you can get like frame relay cards and do X25 or whatnot, which is kind of like outside the scope because you don't have, for instance, the primes out there and the VAXs and whatnot. I was looking for some type of... And I know there are a lot of retro networks out there, that might, you can run an X25 network in to kind of get that feeling, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which actually have like live systems that are out there. It's one thing, but then again, I mean, with like SimH and stuff like that, you can emulate a Prime on a PC now, you know, but how do you get it connected to an X25 now? Anyways, I was actually thinking about that the other night. About how do you create a network? Oh, wait, you're showing me pictures here. I didn't notice you turned this back on.
I turned my camera on because I wanted to show you this because it just is so on topic. It is a PDP 11 replica.
Not original.
it's 50% that size.
That's awesome, though.
Yeah, it's really nice. It of course it has a Raspberry Pi inside with a SimH as an emulator,
right?
And it has all the blinking lights. Let me show you that. So that would be kind of on topic for such a. It takes like 30 seconds to boot. Let me see. It should be booted. Wait.
Awesome. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's really cool. Like this, you can see the link lines.
Yeah, yeah. So that is really, really cool.
So of course, it has a, where is it? This is the halt switch, so I can halt the machine.
Right.
And now I can deposit and all that. So that's, I mean, that would be a proper system to run an X25 node on. If you will,
right. In America, so the Telenet network used to be mostly run off primes, you know, for quite a while. And then they switch them over to, I think, individual hardware. I think it ran on like 6510s or 6502s. And I see you have an OSCOP in the background. Did you go more into the physical electronic side?
Yeah, I always wanted
have
to
you always been
a front engineer, but then programming was so easy that I didn't even have to finish computer science.
I'm actually with you. Actually, I studied electronics for many years. And then in about the mid-90s, I realized I could fix VCRs and microwave ovens for a living. And I decided I'm going to go back to programming.
I mean, I do it. I love it, and but it's more of a hobby thing, and not so much.
See, that's what I want to do. I want to get back more into electronics for more as a hobby thing. Yeah. So, but I also have radio and stuff like that. There's too many things.
There's so many things. I just discovered SMD is just great. I love SMD. My eyesight is bad, so I have to put on the goggles. But then with tweezers, it's just awesome. It's so great. Okay, anyway, Dave, I think I have to wrap up.
Hey, man, you know what? It's been awesome talking to you, man.
Yeah.
I really, really appreciate it. And I'll definitely let you know whenever the X25 thing, and I'm glad we went on and talked about other things, but I'll let you know whenever it comes out, okay?
Thank you so much.
Thank you, man.
Bye-bye.